You may think that you've had the world's strongest coffee, but unless you've had the electric chair blend from Reaper's Brew, well then, my friend, you have not had the world's strongest coffee. There have been days where I needed the energy and motivation to get going, whether it was to work on my podcast or just be productive in general, and Reaper's Brew coffee definitely did wonders for me. To get some Reaper's Brew coffee for yourself, just go to reapersbrew.com and receive 10% off of your first order when you enter in the coupon code UNKNOWNPOD. Again, visit reapersbrew.com and enter in the coupon code UNKNOWNPOD at checkout for 10% off of your first order. December 29th, 1999 was meant to be a happy night of celebration. While the world was heading toward the final countdown to Y2K, in the small town of Vinita, Oklahoma, Ashley Freeman was celebrating her 16th birthday with her parents Danny and Kathy, as well as her best friend Laura Bible. However, by early the following morning, the Freeman home would become engulfed in flames. Danny and Kathy had been found in the burned-down remains of the home, but Ashley and Laura were nowhere to be found. Over the next two decades, there would be many rumors about how the events of the evening transpired. Were Ashley and Laura responsible for the fire themselves and ran off? Were drug dealers who were believed to be connected to Danny Freeman responsible? Or could the sheriff's department even be responsible? The culmination of a long-running feud between the Freeman family and the sheriff's deputy who had shot and killed Ashley's older brother Shane nearly a year earlier. An arrest would finally be made many years later. However, the mystery of what exactly happened to Ashley Freeman and Laura Bible and where they are located is still yet to be solved. In this special episode of the Still Unknown podcast, I will be talking with author Jax Miller, whose new book titled Hell in the Heartland, Murder, Meth, and the Case of Two Missing Girls takes a deep dive into the case. The book is available today by every major bookseller. And if you are listening to this episode on the day of its release, which is July 28th, 2020, Jax Miller will be discussing the book in a virtual event with Magic City Books in Tulsa, Oklahoma, this evening at 7 p.m. Central Time, which you can register to attend through the link I will provide in the show notes. I will also provide a link to buy Hell in the Heartland on Amazon. Also, we recorded this interview over a month ago, and since then there has been some recent developments in the case, so stay tuned after the interview where I will provide the latest update in the case as of this episode's release. Thank you for listening and enjoy my interview with author Jax Miller. Okay, everyone, I am happy to be joined in this episode by author of Hell in the Heartland, which is out today. If you're listening to this on the day it drops, please welcome author Jax Miller to the podcast.
Hey.
Hello, Jax. How are
you? Hello. How are you? Thanks so much for having me on the show. I'm so excited.
Well, I'm so happy to have you on. This is the first time I've ever done anything like this, had a true crime author on.
Oh, wonderful. I get to take your cherry, huh?
Hey, I am honored. And so I guess we'll start off here by asking just if you want to tell the listeners a little bit about yourself, about where you come from and what it is you do.
Sure. So I'm Jax Miller. I'm a writer. I'm an author. I had worked previously in fiction, and that was while I was living in Ireland. I lived in Ireland for nearly 10 years. I am back in America now, and for the past 4.5 years, nearly 5 years now, I've been working on the story out of Oklahoma that Hell in the Heartland is based on, and that's the disappearances of Ashley Freeman and Laura Bible. So that's pretty much what I do, and the book's it's out today. So
how is it that you learned about the case of Laura and Ashley, and what compelled you to want to write about them?
Yeah, I'm not sure. You know, I never have a good answer for that. I'd worked in fiction before that, and fiction was always fantastic for purging my own demons and getting a lot of therapeutic value. I always found it very cathartic. But then I wanted to do something that was a little bit bigger than myself, you know, where I didn't have the legroom for creativity. I wanted to help if I could be a voice to families who needed it. And I'd always been fascinated by the true crime genre ever since I read Helter Skelter at too young of an age. So, I don't know what exactly drew me to this case first. In fact, at the beginning, I had been weighing out other stories to write. And from a strictly storytelling point of view, I was very attracted to this story. I thought it was rich in setting. It was it had a lot of plot twists. It was stranger than fiction. And you know, these are all things that you look at as a storyteller. Of course, you know, several months into it, I started to get very attached. I became very close with the family. So it became more than just writing a story. Then I really just wanted to help any way I could and do everything I could to help them. So.
Yeah, and this is a story that you have said yourself isn't more widely known. It was covered in an Unsolved Mystery segment. It was an episode of Disappeared on ID, but not too many other coverage about this case.
Yeah, they have a lot of regional coverage, and that's because a lot of the reporters are friendly with the family. They've been on the case since day one, so they've been reporting it for many years now, a couple decades now. So there's a lot of that regional, local coverage that's always been there. It always will be there. But as far as national, international, no, there wasn't a lot out there. I mean, like you said, they would have like a one-off episode here or a feature there, but it wasn't ever, you know, it never really gained legs and got off the ground. I tried to do that the best I could with the TV series we did on HLN, Hell in the Heartland, and I hope to continue to do that with the book. I think the book, I hope, will have a good reach, and hopefully we can just continue shining a spotlight on this story. I think it's a story that everyone should know.
Yeah, and I had the pleasure of reading the book myself, reading an advanced copy I got, which I'm thankful I got to do. It's actually a pretty incredible book.
Thank you. Thank you
And
so much.
it's already giving some stellar reviews, including one Mr. Robert Graysmith himself, which is
He's wonderful, isn't he?
incredible. Which is, I mean, they had to do a movie about him, and Jake Gyllenhaal had to play him.
I know. I love David Fincher. I love the film Zodiac. It was really such an honor. I mean, like when they told me that, I screamed. My husband's like, "What's wrong? What's wrong?" I'm like, "Robert Grayson." I was like, "Oh my gosh!" The first thing I did actually was I actually called the Bibles. I called the cousin of Laura Bible. I'm like, and I was crying. She's like, "What's wrong?" I'm like, "It's a good cry." She's just I had to catch my breath and tell her, and she's like, "Who?" I had to explain to her, you know, who he was. And I think that night she watched Zodiac, and she's like, "Oh!" So that was an incredible moment. That was really an incredible. I'm very honored. I was very honored.
So when you decided to write about this case, how did you get yourself in with the family, and was it a long process? I'm sure that it can take some, it's a real effort to earn their trust. So how did you go about doing that?
So, I think it was a mixed bag because the first thing I did when I was looking into this case, I'd researched it for a while before I reached out to anyone. I wanted to make sure I knew what I was talking about the first time I called them. And I was in Dublin and I reached out to Lorene Bible, the mother of missing child Laura Bible. So I reached out to Lorene and she was like, "Sure, come on out," 'cause I told her I wanted to come to Oklahoma. I found out later, you know, her and the Bibles were like, "Well, we didn't really think you'd actually come because I guess a lot of people have expressed interest in writing a story or doing a TV series, blah blah blah, but no one, you know, it just doesn't come to fruition. You know, these things happen." So I went out there, and they were always very open with the Freemans. You know, the family of Ashley Freeman, that was tougher. That took a lot of knocking on doors. Some of my closest sources, it took several years to get. So it was kind of a mixed bag. Some people were happy for me to be there. Some people are still not happy that I'm there. I guess you got to take the good with the bad in these things, you know?
So, did you ever? I got the sense reading the book that there were some dangerous situations that were happening when that were involved in you re during your research.
Yeah, I think it's
Well,
kind of par for the course when you're dealing with active meth heads and meth dealers and meth manufacturers, convicted murderers. I think that there is a real sense of danger, even if you're not in danger. I write a lot about in my book about my anxiety. So a lot of it could have been my perceived danger versus real danger. I did find myself in sticky situations, don't get me wrong. Again, par for the course. And I look back now and I'm like, holy moly, that happened. But again, I always found it worth it. I always knew again that this was something bigger than myself. So it always seemed worth it. I'm like, okay, I had a gun pointed at me, but I got answers. Let's go with this.
so how is it different trying to gain the trust of some of these figures that have less than stellar reputations, so to speak?
Again, I think it's a mixed bag. I met people who were very open to talking, like this fellow named Cowboy, Randy Madewell. He was a former meth cook who was around in that area. He was there when suspected serial killer Jeremy Jones was arrested. So he was very open. He was very honest about who he was and what he did. Some people would let me in and there was a meth lab there. Some people were just open. Others, like I have not been able to touch with a 10-foot pole. So again, it's a real mixed bag. And I think it just depends on personality,
Yeah, and speaking of Cowboy, there has been some developments with him since the book was finished, and
Oh,
some unfortunate
heartbreaking.
one. Yes, and
Heartbreaking. Cowboy was murdered. That was horrible. His brother contacted me. He knew that Cowboy and I were close because it's not just business. It's not just a book. I really care for the people that I talk about. So it was awful when he died. It was really sad. I think, I also want to emphasize a lot of people started connecting dots saying, well, this is because he talked to Jax Miller, or like this is because he spoke out against certain people in the meth trade in Oklahoma. And I think it freaked a lot of people out. I admit, when I first heard about it, that was kind of my idea, like, was this related? But I just want to put out there that they are not related. This has nothing to do with Hell in the Heartland and the story of Laura and Ashley. And the reason I say this is because I do think that there are witnesses in the Laura and Ashley case that have yet to come forward, and I don't want them to see this and be deterred or be fearful. So that's why I'm saying that they were not connected at all. So just to put any conspiracy theory to rest right there.
All right, so with what I do on my podcast, I tend to talk about unsolved cases. This is a case that is there has been someone arrested for their murders, but it's still unsolved in the sense that they it's still unknown. Well, said the name of my podcast there unintentionally, but it's still unknown what exactly happened to them or where they're located.
And that's the thing. And I've said to Laureen Bible, like when they arrested Ronnie Busick and they named other men involved in the murders, and she'll tell you time and time again, like, this is not over. This is not, this is not a conclusion. This is not closure for me until I can bring the girls home, until the girls are found. So, on one sense, it's like, okay, we know who did it, but like, there's still a family who just does not have a grave to visit. They still don't know where their daughter and sister and cousin, you know what I mean? So, and that's their goal. That's their goal, is to find the girls.
And just there have I know from reading the book there were rumors. I don't know if like how accurate these are, but there was talk that they were kept alive for a time after they were abducted and kept alive for a time before they were murdered.
Right.
And
So So the DA's investigator down in Oklahoma had announced that in the 2018 arrest of Ronnie Busick, that there were numerous witnesses who came forward talking about Polaroid pictures and that the girls were seen in the pictures with one or more of the suspects. So that is largely believed to be true. I think the evidence supports that they were kept alive for some time, and that they are dead. You know, it's tragic. I think that the families are resigned to the idea that they're no longer with us, but it's just tragic. It's really just tragic.
It's unfortunate too. Now, was there a connection between Ronnie Busick and the Freeman family? Because there was talk that the father, Danny Freeman, was involved in the local drug scene.
Mm-hmm.
And was there believed to be any connection between them?
You know, that is one of the larger theories, was that they were killed because of Danny's drug lifestyle. For right now, those are just rumors. There was never any physical evidence to connect Danny Freeman to the meth trade. Just in my own, research, which is pale in comparison to the people who are actually investigating this case, like part of the OSBI and the DA investigator and stuff, I never found any strong connection to prove that Danny was into meth. So those are just rumors as of now. Now, will it emerge that was the case? Who knows? Nobody knows. I mean, if we knew, we'd be somewhere else right now. But for now, they're just rumors. So,
well, and there were, multiple theories about this case. I know that the Freemans had been having issue with the sheriff's department in town,
mm-hmm.
due to, like, nearly a year earlier, Ashley's older brother and the son of the family, Shane Freeman, had been killed by one of the deputies.
Right. And those were the two most prominent theories, that this was either drug related or it had to do with the sheriff's office. And I think that those are still the two more prominent theories that stand today. Again, this is just only in my scope of research. I know that investigators, I'm sure they know much more than I do. That is a large theory. That is something that the Freemans have long believed, that there was, that his shooting was unjustifiable. You know, he was shot. He was on a country road. He was 17 years old, and he was shot by a deputy from Craig County Sheriff's Office. And, the family, his parents, thought that this was an unjustifiable shooting. They had planned on filing a wrongful death suit against the county, and of course that never happened because they were murdered less than a year later. So that, I think, naturally brings on the conspiracy theories. And whether or not they're true, again, who knows? None of us were there. So there is no definite answer. Was this drugs? Was this police? Was this this or that? Right now everything's is just theory.
Yeah, and I know like one of the things that can add to that theory is there appears to have been a lot of bungling in this case in the investigation. Like, perfect example, when searching the crime scene, they found one body, which was that of Kathy Freeman. And then they said, they found nothing else. And then Jay and Laureen Bible go the next day and they're poking around themselves and they find another body. It's like, how do you miss a second body? And I rewatched the Unsolved Mysteries segment this morning just to see what else there was. And
mm-hmm.
They also found Laura's wallet or Laura's purse.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like, how are the parents of one of the girls able to find this stuff that the investigators overlooked?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's shocking. I think it begs the question, why did this happen? Why did multiple agencies drop the ball? And it was Lorene and Jay and the family. I know Dwayne Vansel, who was Danny Freeman's stepbrother. I know those first initial d days, you know, after finding Danny, that was, I mean, I think shit hit the fan then. And Lorene was like not having it. She's like, you guys, you know, missed a body in your quote unquote investigation. Now it's our turn, you know. So she took over the scene, the crime scene, and in doing so, and all the agents stepped back, and you know, I think they were a bit red faced. And yeah, they, you know, they found Danny's body. They found Laura's wallet and purse. They found pajamas that the girls were wearing, which they used for privately owned scent dogs. They found a lot of evidence. They found that arrowheads were missing from the home, things like this. So, you know, a lot of the findings at the crime scene were done by the Bibles and the Freemans, you know.
Yeah, and it seems the investigators just, because the initial theory was they only found Kathy, so the theory was, well, Danny killed her and took off with the girls.
Right.
Then they found, then the Bibles found Danny Freeman, and then there became the theory of like, well, maybe the girls did it and took off themselves.
Right.
Which,
And it's also worth mentioning that a lot of the reason why Danny was the prime suspect was that he had a lot of, you know, tension with police that whole previous year since his son died. There was a lot of back and forth on both sides. It was tit for tat, you know, between police and family. So they had already known who he was. They knew he was a hothead. And then there was an anonymous tip that was called in saying that Danny had the girls. And he had said at some point to someone, I'm not sure in what capacity, he said that I'm not giving the girls back until you give me the cop who shot my son. So they were kind of going to, well, at least according to the tip, Danny was going to trade the girls for the deputy, David Hayes. And then, so for the first 24 hours, families are thinking Danny's got the girls, he's on the run, blah, blah, blah. And then the next morning they find Danny and everything's like, well, now we're back to square one. You know, where are the girls? And then they sifted through the crime scene, you know, inch by inch for the next several days.
so you talked about your how it was trying to get the families of Lauren Ashley to talk with you and different figures of that criminal world, so to speak. How did what was it like trying to get investigators to talk with you on this case?
As far as the investigators went, that took a lot of persistence. What I found for me was that at first, the higher level ones, the state agents and such, were happy to talk, and then they stopped real quick. Then they didn't want to talk to me. So a lot of what's in the book are earlier things. I think that while I was there, their own case was progressing, and they got to a point where they just had to stop talking about it because the wheels were turning fast enough for them. You know, when I came to it, it was still quite cold, so they were happy to talk about a cold case. But once it started really picking up again, I think, you know, they really had to focus on their end on the case and do the actual official investigative work. So the higher level, you know, it started off good at the, you know, and then it we lost communication towards the end. However, the local ones, that was the opposite, where they weren't open at first, but after a couple of years, then they started talking to me. So that was interesting. I think I talked to all but one or two of the cops who were on the scene. One of them was dead by the time I got there. So, you know, I was very fortunate to speak with them. You know, I write in the book how I sit down with the Hayes brothers and this one and that one. And so that, yeah, that was, it was really interesting, you know, and I would go visit them at their home. Sometimes I'd meet them at a restaurant, you know, everyone's different. You meet them where they're at. And yeah, that was, I think I did pretty good. So I think I got as much information as I could.
Now, there have also been recent developments in Ronnie Busick's pending case. Is there anything, what is the latest update you can share on that?
So he recently had waived his right to a preliminary hearing. So I think what everyone's hoping for, I'm trying to think of how to word this. He is going to be making a plea very soon. The next court date's on July 15th. This is pre-recorded, by the way, anyone listening. So I don't know. By the time you listen to this, more developments may have happened, because I know July 15th falls between now and publication day. So that's the next court date. So right now I know families are waiting. I think this has taken a little bit longer than people expected, but the family's been patient for 20 years, you know, and hopefully this ends soon for them, this part of it, because I would really hate to see this drag on for them any more than it has to.
Yeah, well, you talk about persistence. I mean, what Laureen Bible has gone through and what she's the fight she has in her is unbelievable.
I don't know how she does it, and I've said that to her, you know, many times. I said, if you know, as a mother, I don't know how she does what she does. I says, I couldn't do it. And she says to me numerous times, she's like, you don't know how strong you are until you have to be. I don't think weakness has ever been an option for her. I don't think quitting has ever been an option. I don't think rolling over in the fetal position like I'd probably be, I don't think that's an option for her. She's just, you know, I have to be my daughter's voice. I have to keep her story alive. I have to keep this out there and just fight. And that's like the only mode she knows, I think, is just keep going. And she's incredible. I really don't know how she does it. I'm really in awe of her. I really am.
And is there anything you can tell me about how Jay is doing?
Jay, you know, I love Jay to death. I love them both. I really do. He's different than Laureen, though. I think Jay is he's more expressive in his emotions. I know when we talk, he'll cry. I mean, he shows his grief much more than Laureen will. But you know, I think he's just as strong. I think we see Laureen more, but you know, he's grieving with her. They're in this together. You know, and I know both of them just hope that soon they can finally bring the girls home. I mean, that's what everybody wants more than anything.
Listen, I hope that can happen for them. Is there do you have any personal theory on what exactly happened with the girls?
I do have a strong opinion, but I am also reserving that. And the reason being is because my mind has changed, you know, over the years in this case. You know, I try to be as open-minded as I can. I know coming into this, I thought it was one person, one of the earlier suspects, Jeremy Jones. I was dead set it was him. And then the more I looked at it, the evidence didn't support it, which I explain a lot in my book. You know, it's not just my opinions. I'm just putting the facts out there. And then my mind changes over time, and then it's like, oh, did this guy, and my mind changes so much, and it's supposed to. I think we should be open-minded, and I think we should, you know, let ourselves bend with the changes and the evidence. So right now, yes, I do have a very strong opinion, but I'm going to keep it to myself because you never know what's going to change. So, yeah, that's, yep.
So what kind of effect did looking into the story have on you?
Profound. This was unexpectedly a very transformative period of my life. It was a very humbling experience. It really knocked me off a lot of high horses, I'll tell you that. I think I went in there one person and I left another person. And I think I was very naive going into it. I think I was a little bit gung-ho, and now I've learned so much, and because of people like Laureen and having these powerful women around me, Laureen and Lisa and Tiffany and you know, who's one of the newscasters down there who's been on the story, and just watching all these incredible people, you know, I've largely found who I want to be, and that's someone who listens more than she speaks. So, you know, if anyone who knows me knows I'm the biggest chatterbox. you know, and like it's also been a lesson in patience and stillness and non-reactivity, and you know, these are something that I try to implement in my life all the time. And I sit and I talk with Laureen and Lisa, And they said, like, you know, we see such a difference in you between when you came into this story and when you left it. And it doesn't come without its hardships. I've had days where I'm crying in my room and about to burn the pages and F this, I'm leaving. You know, I've definitely had those moments. And again, I talk about anxiety, which really reared its ugly head in my life during this period of time. And I suffered greatly with panic attacks and anxiety to the point where I couldn't even speak or leave my house or eat. And I never experienced anything like that before. I talk about that very openly in my book about, you know, my mental health. But through that, again, just surrounding myself with these people, I learned so much about who I was and who I want to be. And I think in many ways, this has molded me into the kind of writer I want to be. You know, and I'm just so grateful for the experience. Yeah.
And are you currently looking into what it is you want to do next?
Oh boy, am I. Yeah, I've been working on something, but I've been keeping a lid on it. Actually, right before coronavirus, I went down to Florida. It was the day that Disney World closed, so everyone was up in arms down there, and I got to speak with a 91-year-old suspect, the only living suspect in the story I'm working on next. And you know, I got to sit with him at a you know, at a homeless shelter and speak with him. And then Corona happened, and I was like, I had to stop. So everything's been on a halt for now. But you know, even though I've been quarantined, I've been working so hard. I've been talking with agents and doing interviews. I've been Zooming and all this fancy technology. So I'm still getting shit done. How about that? I'm still doing what I got to do. But yes, I am working on something.
Well, that's terrific. I mean, a 91-year-old suspect, you're going back in time a
I
bit.
am going back in time a bit. Yes.
So
You
I'm
know.
definitely, after reading Hell in the Heartland, I'm definitely excited for what you're going to do next.
Oh, thank you. So am I. I'm
And
excited too.
yeah, seeing some of the reviews that are getting mentioned for Hell in the Heartland, I saw like one review saying it's the In Cold Blood of the 2020s,
Yeah. Wow. How cool
which.
is that? I wish. I wish I wrote like Truman Capote. For the record, I don't think I'm near. I can't even touch him. But I think Truman Capote is one of the best writers there ever was. I think he's fantastic. I don't think I write that well, but I'm very, very humbled to receive such a compliment.
That's fantastic. And yeah, the book is out today, July 28th, and you can get it from all major booksellers. You can get it on Amazon. And like I said, I had the privilege and the pleasure of reading an advanced copy, and you're definitely going to want to check this out.
Well, thank you. I so appreciate that. That means the world to me. Thank you.
And it means the world to me that you wanted to do this podcast with me.
Oh, we'll
And
do it again soon.
oh, I mean, we can of course do it when we discuss your next book.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. Well, hopefully, you know what it is. It's not that I'm not allowed to announce it or anything like that. But you know, right now with Lauren Ashley, I really want this to be the primary focus, and I don't want to take away from that. And I'm afraid if I start talking about this new case, people are going to focus on that. And right now, I really do want the focus to be on Laura and Ashley. You know, especially through this publishing process, I'm sure it's bringing up a lot of emotions for a lot of the people, and I just want to be sure that I'm very attentive to the family, that I'm attentive for this book and for the girls and their story. So that's why I'm not sharing anything out of respect for the
Oh,
families.
yeah, absolutely. I mean, I totally get it. And believe me, I'm not upset that you're not sure. I'm honored that you even told me you're talking to a 91-year-old suspect. That are,
He's charming.
I mean that's enough of a tease to have us intrigued, and then, you know, while still keeping the focus on Ashley and Laura and the families and
Right. Yeah.
getting them the answers and the justice that they deserve.
Right. And you know, I hope my small, very small role as a writer, I hope I helped in some way. You know, again, I think I went into this one person wanting to write a book, and that's all it was about. And then I really became someone else at the other side. And I really, I mean, from the bottom of my heart, I hope I helped in some way. And I hope that this book does help in some way. If I haven't helped yet, then may it reach the right person who can come forward with more information. And I really do hope someone with information does come forward so that families can finally have closure.
Yeah, and if it helps, if anything, it at least tells properly the story of these girls and the families, and, you know, gets their story out there, if anything else.
Right, right. Yeah, I really wanted to do that. I think a lot of people also will focus on the killers and stuff like that. I really wanted to focus on the victims and bring the girls to life on paper. I really wanted to show you who they were as people and not as victims. You know, this wasn't just the missing child. No, this was the clarinet player, and then this was the one who excelled at track. You know, I really wanted to paint them and show you who they were to those
yeah.
who love them the most.
Yeah, more than just a 10-minute segment on Unsolved Mysteries.
Exactly. So, and I hope I did them justice in this book.
Well, Jax, the book is terrific, and I'm excited for it to be released and for the general public to be able to read it themselves. And again, I highly recommend everyone goes to, if we're still in quarantine, you can buy it off Amazon. You can, you know, and pretty much any major bookseller will be selling this. Again, everyone, the book is called Hell in the Heartland. It is available today at every, on Amazon and every major bookseller. Jax, this was an absolute pleasure. I can't tell you how honored I am to have you join me for this episode.
Oh, thank you. Well, I'm sure you and I will talk again soon. I know we talk a lot off the podcast episode. We do talk a lot. So but thank you for having me. I'm really just so happy that you're there promoting true crime and getting other people's stories out there. So thank you.
Yeah. Yes, and I remember reaching out to you when I first heard about this book, and I remember reaching out to you saying, just shooting my shot, asking you, hey, do you want to do the podcast? Figuring it was a long shot, you actually were thrilled, and ever since, I feel like you and I have become pretty good friends.
I think so too. No, I totally think so. I'm like doing that thing right now. You can't see me, but I'm pointing like my pointer, my middle finger towards my eyes, and then pointing at you. Like I get you. I got you. Yeah. No, totally. I'm happy that you reached out because I think you're doing great. I think you're doing great things, and I'm very excited to be part of your journey and see how far you take this. I'm really excited for you.
Well, thank you very much. And as I told you in one of our private conversations, we're in this. I feel like we're in this together.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
Jax, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, and I look forward to talking to you soon.
All right, and I look forward to talking to you as well. And again, everyone, seriously, go buy this book, and if you can afford it, get it from your library. I know my library is going to have this in stock.
Awesome. Yes. Go buy the book, everyone. Go buy a copy for your mom and your dad and your, well, no, not your kid. Don't let your kids read this. This is a little scary of a book. It's a little scary. But thank you again. Really, I appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, everyone, for listening to my interview with Jax. We recorded the interview in June, and there has been a significant update in the case in the time since. In an article from the New York Times that was dated back on July 15th, primary suspect in the case, 68-year-old Ronnie Busick, pleaded guilty to an accessory to murder charge and received a 15-year sentence. It was reported that he intends to lead investigators to the remains of Ashley and Laura, in accordance with a plea deal that could reduce his sentence. Two other suspects in the case, Warren Philip Welsh and David Pennington, have since passed away, Welsh having died in 2007 and Pennington in 2015. I will be providing any further updates on this case on Twitter, Instagram, and in the Facebook group, and Jax Miller will be doing so as well on her social media. You can follow her on Instagram and Twitter Both are at Real Jax Miller. If you aren't following me on any of my socials, Instagram is at Still Unknown Podcast, and Twitter is at Still Unknown Pod. Thank you for listening, and I will talk to you next time. Stay safe, everyone.
Hi, guys. My name is Miles, and I wanted to tell you about my true crime podcast, Forensic Miles. My co-host Sean and I investigate the cases in every episode of Forensic Files. You've seen the show, you know the crime, but is there more to the story? Let's find out. Check us out on Instagram at Forensic Miles, Miles with a Y, and listen to us wherever you listen to podcasts. See you there.